Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Ryan Dobson here with our physician in residence, Dr. Meg Meeker. And Meg, we have a great privilege of inviting a guest who was hailed by a New York Times reporter as, quote, someone who has quietly become one of the most influential people in America. I like that specifically because it's quietly has become. It's not this take over by force and scream as loud as you possibly can, but it's quietly becoming one of the most influential people in America. I couldn't agree more.
I sure agree with you as well, Brian. And, you know, I've thoroughly enjoyed Andy Andrews' books over the years, and I've had the privilege of sharing stage with him at Dave Ramsey's Smart Conference.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, Ryan, the late Zig Ziglar described Andy as, quote, the best speaker he's ever seen. And I can vouch for that. Andy Andrews is a fabulous communicator. He has so much to say. He says it so well. And I always enjoy hearing what he's going to teach.
I do, too. I was prepping for the program yesterday, and I watched three or four videos and read the book we're going to discuss today, How Do You Kill 11 Million People? But quickly, Andy Andrews is an international speaker, the author of several New York Times bestsellers, including The Noticer, The Traveler's Gift, and, like I just said, How Do You Kill 11 Million People? He has spoken at the request of four different U.S. presidents. He's been called upon by the Department of Defense to speak about the principles contained in his books. Andy, I love having you here. It's always such a pleasure. Thanks for joining us again.
Oh, man. I am honored to be here. I'm such a great fan of you and Meg's and your dad, and so I'm thrilled to be here.
Thank you. You wrote a book called How Do You Kill 11 Million People? That title alone is thought-provoking. How'd you come up with the title? And
well, the title was actually a response to something that bothered me for years. Now, the book is based around the Holocaust, and I've always been a big fan of World War II. I say a fan, a follower.
My dad is too.
I read so much about it. But something always bothered me, and I couldn't figure out really what it was that bothered me until I put it in those words. And here's what I finally couldn't get over is I would watch the Jews loading themselves onto trains, and there would be relatively few Nazi guards. And I would think, you know, why don't they fight? Why don't they run? Mm-hmm. And so my question became, you know, how do you really do this? How do you kill 11 million people? Not what methods do you use. We already know the methods. And I'm not saying how crazy they have to be to do something like this. I'm saying, how do you get these people week after week, month after month, for years, to participate with you in their demise?
Yeah.
Right?
How do you get 11 million people to let themselves be killed?
Exactly. How do you do that? How, you know, what is it that had these people, instead of fighting or running, just loading themselves onto trains? And when I found the answer, it really kind of scared me, because for one thing, I had never heard that question explored. And anytime we would see something like that or hear about it, we would all kind of go, how could this happen? Yeah. And that's all we really think past it. We don't really get any deeper than that. And so when I found the answer, and I knew I had the answer when I found it, I was just blown away. And I'll tell you the answer, because it's very simple. How do you kill 11 million people? You lie to them. You lie to them. And that's what they did. They lied. And the actual number is actually 11,283,000. And it was between 33 and 45 that all this was going on. And one of the things that I found was a specifically written policy of lies that had been created to make this happen. And it was done by Adolf Eichmann. They called him the master. He was the guy in charge of the Final Solution. And he had a three-part policy that they did. The first thing that they would do was to circle these neighborhoods with barbed wire, and they would enclose them. And these were later called ghettos.
Yep.
But they would circle them in barbed wire, and they would tell them, you know, we are doing this for your protection. Yeah. Well, we've heard that. You know, we're just doing this for your own good. Mm. And so we're doing this to protect you because we may have to move very quickly. And if we move very quickly, we don't have to gather everybody. We need to make sure everybody's safe and we know where everybody is. And so then even though they said that, it was obviously a little suspicious to, you know, keep everybody in with barbed wire.
And these are the Jews they're talking to, not other German citizens, correct?
Correct.
Yes. Okay.
The Jewish neighborhoods. And so the Nazi hierarchy at that point would send representatives inside to meet with the Jewish leaders. And get this, Meg, they would take bribes from the Jewish leaders in exchange for better treatment. And that was done so that the Jewish leaders would think, okay, well, we're okay. They're not going to kill us, because if they were going to kill us, they would just take everything.
If they're just going to kill us and take everything, they'd do that anyway.
Right.
And they obviously, if they're accepting bribes.
Why bribe? Yeah.
Exactly.
We're going to be okay.
And so by taking the bribes, the Jewish people kind of calmed down. They said, okay, we're all right. And then the last thing they did, they would gather everybody together, gather the men, and the women and the children would be spread behind them. And this is, I've got the actual words here that were spoken, and they were done most times by Adolf Eichmann, but as this began to expand, it was obviously other Nazi leaders that would do this, but this is what was said.
Bring community leaders from that community up on stage with them, like, we're doing this together.
Exactly. Oh. They would literally bring less than 20 people, very few of them armed. They wouldn't even bring people with...
Even the guards weren't armed.
Right, even the guards weren't armed at this point. And so they would bring these community people there with them, and they would say this. These are the exact words. Jews, at last it can be reported to you that the Russians are advancing on our eastern front. I apologize for the hasty way we brought you into our protection. Unfortunately, there was little time to explain. You have nothing to worry about. We want only the best for you. We will leave here shortly, and you will be sent to very fine places indeed. You will work there. Your wives will stay at home, and your children will go to school. You will have wonderful lives. We will all be terribly crowded on the train, but the journey is short. Men, please keep your families together and board the rail cars in an orderly manner. Quickly now, my friends. We must hurry.
So the enemy presented himself as the friend.
Yeah, and the fathers literally helped their families onto the trains, and once those doors were locked,
that was it.
It was over, because the trains did not stop until they were in Auschwitz or Belzec or Sobibor or Treblinka. And you know, this blew my mind too. A list was drawn up by the German ministry in 1967 that named more than 1,100 concentration camps and subcamps that were accessible by rail. And the Jewish Virtual Library estimates over 15,000 camps in the occupied countries.
It's shocking.
It is shocking.
Yeah. Well, and you start off the book quoting from John 8:32, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." And then you asked the reader, well, if that's true, which we believe it, and I can't believe I've not thought of this. I was watching you on the Dave Ramsey program, and he's right. You put such complicated things into such simple terms that everybody can understand it. So if you believe the truth shall set you free, then the opposite has to also be true. Then if you don't know the truth, and if you're believing in lies, then that will keep you in bondage. And I'm telling you, I put the book down. My wife came downstairs, she goes, "I thought you were reading." And I was like, "I was. I just got to sit here and think about this for a minute." It just kind of hit me right between the eyes. And that's what started this book off for me. What prompted you to write this?
You know, Meg, we've talked about this before, about how we tend to think logically to wrong conclusions.
Yes.
And I began to examine some of the things that we believe that were either terribly misunderstood or altogether wrong. And one of those things that was very curious to me was the difference in history and the past.
Right.
That was very curious to me when I began to understand that, because people believe that history and the past, that's the kind of the same thing. Well, that's your history. Well, that's your past. And they kind of, but it's two totally different things. The past is what is real and true. History is what somebody wrote down.
Right.
Yeah.
Which could be anything.
Which could be anything.
Well, and that's what you realized in researching this, is that oftentimes the guy with the biggest gun and the biggest sword is the one writing the history.
Right. I mean, somebody with an axe to grind, or, as happened many times, the guy with the sharpest axe.
I also thought it was interesting that you could have used a number of other countries as this example, but this is kind of a universal one. We talk about the Holocaust, but you said, I mean, the killing fields in Cambodia, they killed 3 million Cambodians. They only had 8 million citizens at the time. 61.9 million people were killed by the Soviet government from 1917 to 1987. Over 54.7 million of which were Soviet citizens.
Now, that's by their own records. That's their records that say that was their own citizens.
That's right. 2 million Armenians killed by the Turk government. And these were scholars, soldiers, religious leaders. 3 million in North Korea. 1 million killed each in Mexico, Pakistan, the Baltic states. I mean, Andy.
And a lot of places around the world right now are just getting started.
Well, Rwanda, they killed 1 million people with machetes.
There is one common denominator I found, you guys, between all these countries. Every single one of them had one thing that was that was totally in common, and that was it was enabled 100% by the government lying to the people.
Mm.
Every single time. Every.
That's very, that's terrifying when you think about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so often, Andy, as you're talking, we think in wartime, or we think that where masses of people are killed, we think you have a bunch of good guys and you have a few bad guys. The bad guys go in, they, wrestle with the good guys, they kill them, and it's done. But it's not always that cut and dry, is it? As you said, I never realized this about Nazi Germany, that the Jews were so duped, that they were so lulled into believing, into really what you're talking about is cooperating, if you will, with their own death. So it's not just, the big bad bullies coming in, but there's tremendous amount of mental manipulation here,
perpetrated
through these lies.
Yeah. And as much as you guys know about psychology, it is very odd when somebody lies to us. We are programmed to believe it. You know what I'm saying? Have you ever talked to somebody who had been lied to, and you said to them, "Hey, they lied to you," and they said, "No, they said that so and so and so and so." Yeah, I know. They were lying about it.
Yeah,
yeah, but no, they. No, I saw him. I talked to him, and he said. I mean, we seemed adamant and so determined to believe what we are told,
mm-hmm.
because you're not a liar, and Meg's not a liar, and I'm not a liar, and so it just seems inconceivable to us that somebody would look us right in the face and lie to us.
Yeah.
It just seems like that's just out of the realm of possibility.
And people that you trust.
Right.
This happened to my dad a couple of years ago during an election. Someone called and said, we've got a guy running here. It was a friend of his, a friend, someone he's worked with many times, who is a government official. It was an elected official, and called and said, "You got to step into this election. We're about to lose it." And the guy coming in, and he said all these terrible things about the guy that he was running against. And my dad did a couple of commercials for it as a private citizen, a private individual, and they were airing them. And we got a call saying, "Are you sure you want to make that choice?" And we tracked it down. My dad got completely lied to.
Sure.
By a friend who we now don't consider a friend because he lied. I mean, just blatantly lied. And my dad said, "Ryan, what do I do? I mean, I got to make this right." And I said, "Tell him you were lied to. Just tell him the truth. Record a new one for the other guy on your own accord and give it to him." And that's exactly what we did. He came out and he said, "You ever been lied to? It stings. And I can't stand it. And I was lied to, and I've been giving you wrong information. And here's the correction." And we got a bunch of praise for it. And I'm glad we did. I'm glad we didn't just say, "Well, let's just pull the commercial and we'll stop doing it." But he came back out and said, "I was lied to about this man. And guess what? That guy lost." So
it worked out for us in the end. It does. When there are some good people in the process, we can take it back. like that sometimes. We can police it, but it takes somebody to police it. Because the Jews were duped. They were lied to.
Yeah.
They did believe it. However, there was an incredibly large population of people who allowed it to happen. It drives me crazy to hear people, and they're talking about history, and I'm putting finger quotes around that. They're saying recorded history says, you know. And so I hear people say, you know, when Hitler took over, or, you know, when the Nazis took over Germany. And it is a very important for people to realize today, Hitler did not take over. He was elected.
Yep.
Right.
He was elected, and he was elected by 17% of the population.
Yeah.
And the reason he was elected by 17% of the population it was because the vast majority of the German population didn't vote. And so, you know, you look at that and you see, how could this have even happened? Because listen, this was not a— you know, this was not some third world backwater. Germany was a modern— this was an industrialized nation.
Yeah.
They had educated, well-informed citizens, and they had access to print media, radio, broadcast media, world news. And this guy was a man. Hitler was a man of the common people. You know, he'd been a guy in the army, and not some big guy. He was like a lance corporal. And his speeches, though, he could talk, man. He could talk. And he was exciting, and he was passionate. And I went back and I listened to tons of speeches. I saw and read transcripts of tons of speeches. And over, there was a curious little pattern here. He always promised more and better and new and different. And he said, we're going to change this thing, and we're doing it now. And you could see, you could start to designate, Meg, you could go where when he would go in one area, he would be speaking about one thing, go in another thing. And of course, there was no internet.
If he was talking to farmers, he'd talk to he'd talk about agricultural and doing that.
Yeah.
If he was talking to business leaders, he would talk about taking away regulations to help small business and big business. If he was talking to the unions, it was that.
Exactly.
It was different things to different people.
And there was no internet. Or anything like that to really kind of call him on it, to track him on it. And we only have, you know, hindsight to really see what happened. But one of the things that he said that was recorded, that he said, how fortunate for leaders that men do not think.
Yes.
Make the lie big, make it simple, keep saying it, and eventually they will believe it. Now get this, in his autobiography, Mein Kampf, he wrote, the great masses of the people will more easily fall victim to a big lie than a small one. And the book was a bestseller in Germany, widely read, and the people believed him anyway.
Or
at the very least, they ignored him.
Yeah.
That reminds me, Andy, of something we were talking about in an earlier show, and that is you were talking about the importance of teaching our kids to think and really critically thinking and how important it is in terms of something like this to teach children, you know, that's kind of what I'm all about, teaching children how to think and how to discern truth and find truth rather than just sort of swallow everything that's given to them or spoken to them in a very charismatic way.
It's so important that we do this.
Yeah.
Because bad things come in pretty packages. And to be able to have the discernment of the lie, it is so important. And a lot of times people are reading about this or they know colloquially about it. And so they talk about the Jews and when the Jews were killed. But I think it's important that people know, because I kind of don't think people know, in these camps, it wasn't just Jewish people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, 11 million people exterminated, 5 million of them were not even Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
In Dachau, which was one of the largest and, you know, one of the most memorable of all the camps, only a third of the population was Jewish. You know, people see movies and they see the yellow stars that the Jews were given, the yellow triangles. Do you know, get this, do you know, because my research uncovered this and this blew me away. Do you know the other colors that were used? Have you heard of the other colors?
Yeah.
The brown triangles identified gypsies and people of Roman descent. Roman descent, that's Italians. Purple triangles were worn by Jehovah's Witnesses, Catholic priests, and Christian leaders who ran afoul of the government. Black triangles, you got a black triangle, that just meant you were a vagrant, but you were given a black triangle if you were stopped on the street or stopped anywhere and you lacked documentation of a permanent address. Blue triangles were given to people who had moved to Germany from other countries. Can you imagine? Unless you were Jewish, and then they wore yellow. Red triangles were worn by a huge group. You wore red if you were a member of a trade union. You wore red if you're a Democrat or any number of a category that is a political nonconformist. Okay. Pink badges were for homosexuals. Green badges were given to common thieves and murderers. And get this.
Oh, yeah.
The common thieves and murderers were not suspect politically. So it was the common thieves and murderers, the green badges, who were put in charge of the others. And all these badges, you got to understand, they went after the Jews first.
Right.
And so all these badges, red, pink, brown, blue, black, all these badges were worn by the mothers and fathers and children who were not the first to go to the camps. Their badges were worn way after they got a good look at the yellow ones and didn't do anything.
Well, and that's what I think is shocking. It's one thing to get fooled the first time around. It's another thing to see other people get fooled and then to allow yourself into the same boat. Andy, you say in the book that there are elected leaders today using the same methodology that the Nazis were using, lying to people to get them to do what they want or to achieve certain goals. Can you give us examples of that? And how do we as people decipher when someone's lying or telling the truth?
Well, you know, there's that old joke. You know, how do you tell a politician's lying? His lips are moving.
Yeah.
You know, I don't necessarily think that.
That's not that funny anymore,
is
it?
Yeah, it's not. It's not really funny anymore. You're exactly right.
It was funny at one point, and now I think people just kind of throw up their hands and go.
That's a problem. We'll talk about
that
in a
minute. You assume they're lying.
Yeah. And you know, honestly, I guess I could give you a lot of examples, but I don't need to give you a lot of examples. You know a lot of examples. And go on the internet. Go on PolitiFact.com. Go on any of these websites that track what they say, you know, because there are websites that track every single speech that politicians give. And you know, I think PolitiFact is the one that gives, like, the Pinocchios, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can find in our age of the internet and in our age of YouTube, it's very easy to find out who's lying and who's not, and who's stretching the truth and who's not. But I think that what we have to do is we have to hold them to a higher standard, because we've lowered our standards. You know, the government we have now is because we've allowed it. We've lowered our standards to the point that this is just what we get.
Mm-hmm. Andy, we've got a little bit of time left, but there was a story in the book that I don't think I'm ever going to forget. It was one of those moments where there's been a few moments in life where I think to myself, I'm never going to forget this. That's going to be a changer for me.
Do you mind me reading this?
I'd love it.
Because it was a deposition that was done after Nuremberg. And here's what it was. Because, you know, people say, well, why didn't somebody stop him? You know, why didn't anybody know? Well, they knew. They knew. And here's the deposition. It says, we heard stories of what was happening to the Jews, but we tried to distance ourselves from it because we felt, what could anyone do to stop it? Each Sunday morning, we would hear the train whistle blowing in the distance, then the wheels coming over the tracks. At church, we became disturbed when we heard the cries coming from the train as it passed us by. We realized it was carrying Jews like cattle in the cars. Week after week, the whistle would blow. We dreaded to hear the sounds of those wheels. because we knew that we would then hear the cries of the Jews en route to a death camp. Their screams tormented us. We knew the time the train was coming. And when we heard the whistle blow, we began singing hymns. By the time the train came past our church, we were singing at the top of our voices. If we heard the screams, we sang more loudly, and soon we heard them no more. Years have passed, and no one talks about it now, but I still hear that train whistle in my sleep. Mm. And the question for us, Ryan, Meg, is how loudly are we singing?
Wow, what a chilling and compelling story, Andy. I hate to do this, but we're going to have to break for today, and I just want to thank you so much for being here.
I am honored to have spent the time with you guys, and I appreciate it and look forward to next time.
Good.
And if you'd like to pick up a copy of Andy Andrews' book, How Do You Kill 11 Million People?, or to find out more about the ministry of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk, you can call us at 877-732-6825 or visit our website, drjamesdobson.org. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you again next time right here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
Family Talk is not affiliated with Focus on the Family.